Hello everyone and welcome to our next episode. Today our topic is Russia Gate and how Russia influenced European politics, especially in the case of Netherlands. And it's great pleasure to welcome Hugo Rass. He's a journalist at Follow the Money, and I would like to read about him. He is a criminologist turned investigative journalist with a special interest in corruption, money laundering, sanctions, geopolitics, and transnational money flows. He has written multiple articles on ties between Russia, Russian elite, and Dutch financial legal industry. Hugo, thank you very much for coming all the way from Utrecht. It's a great pleasure having you here today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm pleased to join your conversation.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you very much. Nice.
And I want to actually start broadly about this topic, because last episode we discussed sanctions. Actually, Tom and our other colleague, Julia Mayer, discussed with Dr. Francesca Ghiumelli about the sanctions and, broadly speaking, how Russia or the sanctioned countries can find a way to sideline it. And today a topic, since it's about the Russiagate again, European Union, I'm wondering broadly how easy or how difficult it is to influence the European politics or Dutch politics by countries like Russia or any other country?
Well, I think it's very easy to sideline sanctions in general. Also, of course, Russia has some friends in the EU still. Take, for example, Hungary. If the EU wants to develop a new economic approach of economic warfare, I think they really have to get countries like Hungary, but also maybe Cyprus or the Netherlands, more on board, because the Netherlands in itself is a tax haven. So a lot of capital flows via the Netherlands. And even with sanctions, Russian money can still easily flow via the Netherlands, although it has been reduced in the last couple of years. But I think the Netherlands has a problem with the Russian flow of capital through its financial industry.
Yeah, very good point. And then you mentioned the Hungary and Netherlands as well. For our students and those also, we have a lot of international students as well. Why do you think Netherlands, maybe a bit background information, is an ideal place in terms of a financial sidelining certain rules or attractive place? Like what makes Netherlands a financially attractive place for Russia?
I think it has to do with a couple of things, because for the Russian elite, it's always, for oligarchs like Abramovich or Mikhail Friedman, it's always the question if their money is still safe in Russia. And often they don't think so. So they try to move it out of Russia as well. And the Netherlands has a whole industry of financial advisors, of legal advisors that really know how to make a corporate structure you can funnel your money away with, like, anybody noticing. And that makes the Netherlands a very, very attractive country, because there's also a lot of tax treaties with, like, it has the most tax treaties of any country in the world, I believe.
So tax haven, basically.
Yeah, it's a very tax haven. But there's also another issue, and that is regarding asset protection, because you know, probably heard of the Yukos saga about how Mikhail Khodorkovsky was stolen of his company, etc. And when he was thrown into jail, the old minority shareholders of Yukos wanted to protect the foreign assets of the old company. So what did they do? They found some legal advisors in the Netherlands, and they made a corporate structure, a Dutch corporate structure, with a foundation and a couple of limiteds. And that proved to be a very effective way of protecting the foreign assets of Yukos. So the Russian Federation, they had to start a legal case with the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague, the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. But they didn't succeed in getting the foreign assets of Yukos back. So the minority shareholders actually won the case against the Russian Federation. And the Russian Federation has to pay a lot of money to the old shareholders. So of course, it's the question whether they will do it. Probably not. But the Yukos case itself showed that the Netherlands is a very good country for a Russian oligarch to protect your assets, and Russia can't enforce it over there. So I think these are the main two reasons that Russian elite finds the Netherlands so attractive to bring their money to.
And what do you think then Dutch politics thinks of this, right? Because there are, in brackets, good oligarchs or bad oligarchs. So how does the Netherlands regard this? What do you think?
Well, I think as it gets that attention in the last years, but of course, the Netherlands for a long time had a policy of fostering business, so low taxes, etc., to attract foreign capital. So, but this was a political choice. And of course, it has brought a lot of benefits because the Dutch economy is really booming, etc. It's a good, stable economy, you could say. But you also attract a type of money flows that you maybe don't want. For example, the whole Yukos case, of course, was a, maybe how do you say, political battle between one of the richest guys of Russia and one of the most powerful guy of Russia. But it's happening, the battle is happening in your courts as well. And I think that it was never really thought through what it would mean if you open up your economy to all kinds of capital. And what my impression is that some politicians know that this problem has been created, but maybe don't know how to solve it, or maybe think it's easier just to ignore the problem rather than to fix it.
Yeah, or how to fix a problem without getting rid of the benefits.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
That's always the case, right? Because after the continuation of this invasion of Ukraine, which started in 2014, I remember I read an article on NOS about the sanctions, and a legal company, a Dutch legal company in Amsterdam, kind of resisted not to implement the European sanctions because they said the Russian business elite or the customers actually paying the highest fee among all the customers for this company, and they were quite reluctant to implement this European sanctions because they said this will cost us a lot of budget. So in the end, the income and the economic interest, I feel like, dominate the political interest or other values maybe. And recently you published together with your colleague, I think I've read two episodes of this, mm-hmm. A case, Russian-Dutch citizen, let's say.
Blaustein.
How he sidelined or created a kind of financial empire for himself and his Russian friends in the Netherlands. Maybe you can tell us background information about it. Who is this person? How this case developed for our listeners?
Yes, of course. So this man named Vadim Blaustein was actually a Russian emigre. He came to the Netherlands in the 90s, and he really presented him. And first, he presented himself as a Jewish immigre and needed to get asylum in the Netherlands because he was threatened due to anti-Semitism. While the Dutch immigration service didn't buy it, and it appeared also not to be true. Then he lied again about his reason for a departure. And eventually the Dutch police wanted to deport him. But then 2 days before he was to be deported, he married to a Dutch woman, or a Belarusian woman that is now nationalized to Dutch.
Very convenient.
Very convenient. 2 days in advance. I don't know how he did it, but he pulled it off. And then from around 2010 onwards, he really expanded internationally. So he started his trust company, expanded to Belize, British Virgin Islands. Actually, any tax haven, he had a company.
What kind of company?
A transformation company, you could say. So he had like all kinds of limiteds from different tax havens. And of course, not every tax haven is same or has the same benefits. So a different client often means different approach or different structure, et cetera, et cetera. And then he found a loophole in the Dutch immigration law, because you can apply for asylum in the Netherlands if you're a high-skilled migrant or laborer, which means that if you have a certain set of skills for IT or something else,
you can apply to a visa.
Yeah, exactly. But in order to get such an asylum, you need to get a contract with the company, which takes like 4,000 months salary, for example, for a couple of years. So, but what did he do? He just created those companies himself, and his clients were paying for their own salaries. And via this company, they would
get a resident permit.
Yeah, they would get a residence permit, but also receive their own salary. So on paper, it appeared that they were legitimate workers. But in fact, they didn't do any work. They just paid him 4,000 euros. And then via some companies on Panama or Hong Kong, they received the money back. So they didn't do actually any work. They just paid for their own salary.
On paper, they are just highly skilled migrants or highly skilled workers in the Netherlands.
Exactly. Because what we saw is there were a couple of police interviews with these so-called high-skilled migrants. And when the police asked these migrants to tell something about the work, they couldn't provide any really proof or just answers that made any sense.
And who were they in reality? Right, Russian oligarchs, rich people that they wanted a resident permit in the Netherlands, or?
Well, it were not like the, how do you say, the Abramovich's of these
mega oligarchs.
Not the mega oligarchs, but there were some people that were very interesting. For example, Arne Treholt, you know, the infamous Norwegian spy for Russia. He was a director of one of the companies that was founded by Blaustein. He didn't apply for the residence permit via Blaustein, but he still was a director of some Dutch foundation. And why, we don't know. But it was very obscure because he was together with another Russian businessman, which was accused of money laundering via some cryptocurrency platforms. So very sketchy. But others, one guy that you could consider as an oligarch that was also a client of Blaustein was Sergei Rodionov. Uh-huh. He describes himself as the poorest oligarch. But he has a wife, which is a nude model, and she actually went to the Netherlands to apply for such a visa, and she received it from the Dutch authorities, thanks to Vadi Blaustein. But when the police started to ask for the company that she was supposed to work for, nobody knew her or could tell anything about her. So she was not like a real employer, but just on paper.
So basically, when we look at this picture, it's quite a... sounds quite complex, but also quite simple in a different way, that apparently Russian than a secret service is behind this, plus a businessman, a kind of a businessman, and helping middle-class business people to do money laundering in the Netherlands and to get a resident permits that is illegal. And how this case now going on? So where is this person and how he has a catch up, as a follow-up?
Yes, well, I went to court a couple of weeks ago because his case was starting in the court of Amsterdam. And his lawyer told the court that Blaustein is residing in Dubai, officially due to medical reasons. He has to get checks every 3 months in an hospital over there. So he wasn't able to show up for his own trial. But I talked to my colleague, Sima Eklemboom, with who I did the articles. And he said, yeah, it happens very often that businessmen who are accused of fraud or money get sick in advance of their trial. So, of course, I don't have proof to say that he's lying about his medical situation. Mm-hmm. But it is very convenient for him that he has this situation with regards to his own trial at the moment. So it will take another month before before the judges make their case.
Yeah,
but it looks like that there will be a conviction for him. But
so what would this conviction entail then?
I believe it's 2 years and some fines, because the prosecutor also, they couldn't ask for more years to him, but the Dutch prosecutor has also taken some other factors into account. For example, the case was also a lot of times in the media, which is always something to reduce your sentence.
Yeah.
And second, the case has taken a very long time because the court case, the trial only started like a couple of weeks ago, but they started the whole investigation in 2013. So it has taken some time before the case came to trial. And that's always always a factor that reduces your sentence.
But we can imagine that he will stay in Dubai, probably, right? He will be sentenced, but he won't actually...
extracted to the Netherlands.
Yeah, yeah, it's very doubtful whether he will service his sentence. I think he will stay in Dubai.
And probably the Blaustein case is not the unique one, I can imagine, especially in the Netherlands or in Europe. Because I remember during the World Cup, there was another scandal or in the European Parliament on politics about the Qatar Gate. And today our topic is about the Russia Gate. And what does this kind of case tell us regarding the vulnerability of the Dutch politics or the European politics, and how easy it is for the authoritarian countries like Russia to influence and to get away with certain rules and norms within the EU or within the Netherlands?
Well, I think that this case really tells you how vulnerable the financial system is, because you have to realize this Blaustein guy, he practically did everything himself. It's not like he had like a really large network of people that he really trusted, but a lot of his work he was doing himself. He was always working. So you have to realize that there's this one guy with an office that can really bring in a lot of Russians if he wants to. If he had better connections within the Russian elite, he could also attract other people. So the fact that just one guy with like a plan can really just smuggle a lot of people in or facilitate a lot of corrupt money flows shows you how vulnerable the system is.
Yeah, and these people also can also influence the European politics as well, right? For example, sure, right now, ongoing discussion about sanctioning Russia, extending sanctions or increasing sanctions or creating misinformation within the Netherlands. Do we know anything about his or any other cases that these people try to buy politicians or influence politicians?
Well, of course, in the Netherlands, a lot of attention goes to Thierry Baudet, of course, because he has this pro-Kremlin rhetoric. Yet it doesn't appear that he is really being paid by the Kremlin. It's more that he's been used as the so-called useful idiot in this case. So I think there are not lots of examples of politicians being bought by, for example, Russian oligarchs. But it's also because of the nature of the Dutch financial system and the nature of political financing in the Netherlands, because it often happens very obscure via different kinds of corporate structures that are really hard to unentangle, to really show how the money is flowing.
Yeah, I was wondering, because I think it's really impressive work that you do, right? That you do this investigation. But how is that for you? Are there any safety concerns as well? Because we're dealing with Russians, as we know.
Or network of even criminals, as you said, that the director was a spy for the company, right? So how does it work indeed?
Well, of course, I think you also see globally that journalists are more often under attack. But for me personally, I usually write about Dutch lawyers being an agent or working for the Russian elite. So for me, there's also a kind of a distance between me and them, because I often write about their enablers. I don't write about Abramovich or Friedman himself. So that's the difference. Because if you take Michael Friedman, for example, the guy behind the Alpha Group, he has a track record of libel cases against a journalist. For example, this journalist from the Financial Times, Catherine Belton. She wrote a book about Putin and his corruption activities called Putin's People. And she was also sued by some of the oligarchs that were really well connected to Vladimir Putin. And they did so with success in the UK, because there are like a lot of different editions of the book. And every edition, some information is missing because the publisher said, okay, we don't want to get in trouble or do this very expensive legal case with them. So we just throw it out and we keep the book like it is. So, but for me at the moment, I do not have any particular security concerns. But it is something that we talk about on our office.
Do you have any legal concerns in terms of, like, as you said, this Financial Times author got it? Maybe not for you personally, but for the newspaper itself can be a legal case that you guys are spreading a misinformation or information that is not actually accurately mentioned or kind of complicated or contested. Any example from the editorial?
Well, my chief editor, Erik Smit, who's also the founder of the platform, have some experience in the past with this, because he wrote about a woman named Nina Brink, which was behind World Online. It was some company that had a really high value, but she kind of defrauded the investors afterwards. Maybe too complicated story to dive into. But Erik wrote about her, and then she started this libel case against him. And so he said it did leave an impression on him, but it also meant for him that he really needed to train his journalists, like, whatever you are writing, it needs to be accurate. It needs to be 100% bulletproof, also legal bulletproof, which of course has always been the intention, but we're very sharp when it comes to that. And for me personally, my first articles were mainly about the biggest law firms in the Netherlands. And they no one of them ever started something legally against me.
What's the name of the law firm? For example,
Houthoff. It's the law firm that is nowadays known as Kremlin aan de Zuidas, Kremlin on the South X, because it has really a lot of Russian clients, like the Russian Federation itself, for example. Because earlier we talked about the Yukos case.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Houthoff is defending the interest of the Russian Federation in that case. And they have been doing so for a lot of years. And so they gained this nickname, Kremlin aan de Zuidas. So, and we talked to some people that used to work for Houthoff, and it appeared that there were also more Russian clients, because it was known that they acted on behalf of the Russian Federation in that case. But there were more Russian interests, more Russian clients.
So Dutch company, a biggest Dutch law company.
One of the biggest, top five.
Exactly. So defending the rights of the Russian Federation, Russian oligarchs in the probably Dutch court or European court.
Yes.
That sounds very ironic as well, right? A lawyer is, lawyer should defend.
Well, but everybody is entitled to a lawyer, right?
Exactly.
So,
and they get the highest paid the smartest.
Well, actually, we also got some internal documents during the investigation. And there was one document that revealed the tariffs that they were using for their clients, because they have different hour rates. And like the highest rate, which was like 750 euros, or maybe no, 800 euros an hour, it was called the Kremlin tariff, because that were like the best clients to have, because they pay the most.
Wow.
For most law firms, it's not like from a PR perspective, it's not that great to have the Russian Federation as a client.
Yeah.
But it also means that the Russian Federation maybe doesn't have that many options, so they are willing to pay more.
Yeah, so basically, now these days I'm reading a book, it is World for Sale, and it says that when there is a high risk, that means there is a high income and high financial gain.
Exactly.
So this is...
Exactly.
Is the Blaustein, as you said, this Russian oligarch's lawyer, is also coming from this law company, or who is this company that they're defending his rights then?
No, well, he's a classic one-man show, you could maybe say. He's not really part of the, how do you say, the Dutch Wall Street, the Zuidas, it is called. He's also not operating from Amsterdam, but he's operating from Amersfoort, which is a smaller city in the province of Utrecht. But this guy really is more a solo guy. He really operates on himself. And of course, he did some things. And regarding Houthoff, it's a large law firm, but it's not the only law firm that worked for Russians, because ever since the Yukos case started in the Netherlands, the whole legal industry saw like, okay, this is going to be some big case.
There's a benefit.
Yes, a lot of lawyers are needed to represent the different interests. So the whole industry saw like, okay, this is a market we can really start. And so, for example, another large law firm, maybe the largest of the Netherlands, Loïs Loef, for a while had something called the Russia CIS desk, which was designed for their Russian or post-Soviet clientele. And there are other firms as well. So it's a whole industry, you could say.
Is running by problems. When there is a problem, they make a lot of money in the Netherlands and they make a lot of business out of it. So there is a positivity in the negativity, kind of. So apparently, or maybe probably, we will learn in the future as well that there are a lot of beneficiaries from these current Russian sanctions that making a lot of money, maybe within the Netherlands, of course, outside Netherlands as well. The companies like loyal companies or trust companies or maybe the banks that they are always accused of laundering Russian money. So we will hear it. Well, I think it was really interesting to listen to this case, and we will also share articles, at least the links, on our podcast, if we may, for our readers as well.
Yeah, we can put them in the show notes.
Yes.
Yes, nice. Exactly. So thank you very much, Hugo, for this interesting conversation. It was really useful to talk about it. And thanks a lot for listening. And please follow us all these online platforms. We are now available Apple, Spotify, and other platforms. Thanks a lot, and have a nice week ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. Cheers.